Attention. 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 News of the day. The children are watching comedy. Be sure that you interpret even the brainwashing that is in the comedy of Donald Duck. A gigantic breakthrough for the National Liberation Front of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, expected to be the next state of U.S. imperialism, its National Front of Liberation has taken over the Chilean consulate, holding the chief consul and three high officials beside him. For the four that have been held hostage through the night in USA's territory of Puerto Rico, the Puerto Rican Liberation Front requires the release of four Puerto Ricans, the longest jailed political prisoners in the entire world, who have been held since the early 50s for allegedly conspiring to do bodily harm to members of Congress. The Puerto Rican National Liberation Front has given until tomorrow for the United States to decide to release these prisoners who have been in jail nearly 30 years as political prisoners in imperialist USA. If they are not released at that time, the Puerto Ricans holding the fascist official, the fascist officials, the consul, and his chief protocol aides, four in all. Chile, of course, is the fascist state ruled by military junta, the military junta of Pinochet, General Pinochet, that was put in power by our tax dollars and the murderous campaign of the CIA. Fighting has temporarily come to an end in the troubled central and northern part of Lebanon. Syria has given the fascist Christian forces 24 hours. After that, they will take control of the phalangist-controlled or fascist-controlled part of Lebanon. There is great concern in Lebanon, and rightfully so, that there may be a partition, because half are Christians who are fascists, Nazis, murderers, terrorists, as far as their political party orientation goes, and the Muslims who are left and radical left. Beirut is calm for the first time in days, as artillery shells had been firing back and forth from the Christian fascist sector to the Muslim socialist sector of the beautiful capital of Lebanon, Beirut. It was considered the pride of the Near East. American University was there. It was considered the most beautiful city in the world. But in the past years, it has been devastated by the civil strife and religious bigotry between the fascist Christians and the socialist Muslim. 30 bombs have been set off in different places of Corsica. Look it up on your map. Near France, a colonial territory of France. Anti-French separatists claim responsibility, who are demanding the Corsican Liberation Front independence for the troubled island of Corsica. The attack is at the capitalist absentee owners, business class in France and USA, that make most of their money from tourism on the beautiful island of Corsica at this time of year. The entire country is in bedlam. this news just coming in. The ceasefire has been agreed on Syrian terms. Syria is to take over all areas that has been held by the powerful right-wing fascist Christian group. Partition hangs in the balances. That is, Lebanon may be divided into a Christian Lebanon, which would be neo-fascist, and a Muslim Lebanon that would be left. Dreadful to see a country divided over religion. You've seen it in Ireland. Hostile Syrian forces said that they would invade Lebanon in spite of United Nations peacekeeping forces there, who they claim are being manipulated by U.S. imperialists and their capitalist lackeys in NATO. With the threat of the invasion by Syria, the ceasefire was called. Egypt has agreed to directly take part in talks with the Israelis, the Zionist fascist government of Israel, in London, the beginning of next month. Encouragement for peace resolution does not come, however, from Israel, said Egypt, but only from the United States. Egypt will make no further concessions, says Anwar Sadat, who is now a dictator due to the foolishness of his own people voting in a referendum. Sadat is on his way to Austria to negotiate further alliances, make him less dependent upon the USA. He wants to form more alliances with the Third World and non-aligned nations. Brezhnev of the Soviet Union has called for increased agricultural production. Effects are expected to be of a drastic nature on the gold market and food prices, and perhaps even the well-being of the capitalist economy. The Soviets have been plagued with bad weather for several years, which the Soviets have rendered the suspicion that they feel that there is some tampering with meteorology, with weather, over their country by the CIA. USA says that agricultural production being at low par in the Soviet Union is due to poor collective system. One half hectare farm is given to every family that wants it in the Soviet Union, and those families that have taken the one half hectare, less than a half an acre, produce over one third of the food, thus showing that there is still some incentive to individual ownership. It dies slowly. The cooperative spirit, which is the only way to save mankind, dies very, very slowly, unfortunately. High-ranking KGB official, the Soviet secret police, who was recently promoted to the Interior Ministry, General Ariski, was shot to death tragically today. It is suspected that dissident Zionists are responsible. He was 52 years of age. He was not known to be a brutal figure, even according to the BBC, in the KGB. Zionists have hailed it as a symbolic protest to the lack of freedom for Jews to immigrate to the fascist Zionist state of Israel. This is practically the main points of the news anyway. The National Liberation Front, as I said, in Corsica, has brought about bedlam in that beautiful island, as in the past days they are responsible for over 200 bombs being detonated besides the one that went off today. Guyana and Brazil and Ecuador and Venezuela are working together on joint efforts, agreements to save the forest, the last purely untouched woodland, bush forest left in the world. Libya and Niger are meeting with Sudanese Prime Minister, who is chairing the meeting in Libya, to seek a solution to end the bitter civil war in Chad that has been inflamed by the presence of U.S. puppet France and its imperialist armed forces who are fighting on the territory of Chad at the present time. In Memphis, Tennessee, a state of emergency has been called, as 300 fires have been started by the Memphis firemen to protest the unjust wages of the city firemen. After the three-day strike had gone into nearly the fourth, the militia, the National Guard, moved in and have arrested all of the firemen, and many of them will receive serious charges of conspiracy to arson. But whatever little will there was amongst the working class firemen, it has been broken. It's interesting to see that these who maintain law and order, as we saw with the Los Angeles police, went around breaking things and breaking windows to protest when they were on strike, the San Francisco police rather, and now the firemen, that they're so quick to condemn blacks who seek bread when they're hungry. But here they've set 300 fires in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, to protest their unjust working conditions. I thought I would give you today some background of the labor movement in USA on the way to the 8-hour day, the Haymarket Affair. It was written by David Walshinsky. Today, most people take it for granted that a work week is 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. But it was not always so, and USA has not come very far since 1886, when it was established. The Soviet Union had a 6-hour day, but the capitalists still maintain rigidly the 8-hour day that was worn in the late 1880s. As late as 1886, most laborers worked a 10-hour day minimum, and some 14. All worked 6 days a week. Most transportation workers put in at least 84 hours a week, and New York City bakers worked 120 hours a week. The struggle for an 8-hour day led to one of the most dramatic events in U.S. history, the incident that has come to be known as the Haymarket Affair. You will be tested over this. Be sure to do your news comprehension for People's Rally tonight. There will be testing. In 1884, a weak labor organization, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor, unions of U.S. and Canada, resolved to make May 1st, Labor Day, 1886, a target date for a movement to win the 8-hour day. As that date approached, the Federation had all but faded away, but their idea caught on, and in Chicago, Illinois, which was a hotbed of worker organizing, the month of April saw huge rallies in support of the 8-hour day, despite unanimous opposition from all the Chicago-owned monopoly capitalist daily newspapers and all business leaders, of course. On April 30, the railway and gas company employees, the iron mill workers, The meat packers and the plumbers all went on strike. The next day, May 1st, 30,000 workers struck and joined in peaceful parades and demonstrations. Sunday, May 2, was quiet. But on Monday, May 3rd, there were strike rallies throughout the city. One such gathering of the lumber shovers union attracted 6,000 strikers, including several hundred workers from the nearby McCormick Harvester Factory, which had been run by scabs since February. Scabs are those who will go and take a union man's job. Scabs had run it since February 16th, when its regular employees had been locked out over a dispute about unionization. The main speaker at the rally was August Spies, S-P-I-E-S, a noted Chicago socialist revolutionary. Many in the crowd objected to his being allowed to speak because he was a socialist. But the secretary of the union spoke on his behalf and satisfied the crowd by saying that Spies had been sent, August Spies, that is, his name is spelled just like the month of August, had been sent by the Central Labor Union. Spies avoided revolutionary propaganda and spoke mainly about shorter hours, urging the workers to stand together or be defeated. Shortly before he concluded his speech, the bell at the McCormick factory, four blocks away, rang, and 500 members of Spies' audience, those who were McCormick strikers, broke away and ran toward the factory. With stones and sticks, they attacked the existing scabs who were exiting from their work and drove them back into the factory. Soon, 200 police with clubs and revolvers arrived to supplement the permanent police force which the city had graciously supplied to the owners to protect the factory. As the police always know, and the army represent the ruling business class. That's why they must be taken over. If you are truly socialist in your thinking, cannot come, socialism does not come, through voting, the electoral, or the parliamentary process. Shooting broke out. And when the battle ended, one striker was shot to death. Six were seriously, critically injured. And six policemen were slightly injured, although none of the policemen had been shot. August Spies, who had urged the McCormick strikers to stay at the rally, was horrified at the sight of the blood of fellow workers splattered on the streets of Chicago and immediately ran off a poster, "To arms, we call you, to arms," printed in English and German, which was distributed at labor meetings that night. The Chicago Capitalist Press, and all the newspapers are capitalists, put the blame for the violence on the socialist and anarchist and a liquor-crazed mob. But the workers thought otherwise, and Tuesday morning found them in an ugly mood. There were clashes all day, including another bloody battle at the McCormick plant. That night, there were several meetings scheduled, but the biggest one was expected to be the demonstration against police brutality to be held in Haymarket Square. Only 1,200 to 1,300 persons showed up, so the rally was moved to a truck wagon in front of the Crane Brothers factory nearby in Chicago. The first speaker was Spies, who gave a relatively mild 20-minute speech in which he attacked the capitalistic press for lies against the cause of labor. He blamed the employers, the business capitalists, and the police for the violence. McCormick is the man who created the row Monday, and he must be held responsible for the murder of our brothers. Cries of "hang him, hang him." "Don't make any threats. They are of no prevail." "They are of no avail," said Spies. "Whenever you get ready to do something, do it. And don't make any threats beforehand," said the socialist August Spies. At 9 p.m., the second speaker, Albert Parsons, mounted the truck. Parsons, a noted socialist, and past anarchist leader, married to a black woman, was born in Alabama, and served in the Confederate Army. He then alienated his distinguished family by marrying a black woman named Lucy Gonzalez and becoming involved in socialist radical causes. This evening, sensitive to the volatile atmosphere, he was less incendiary than usual, choosing to speak on the general state of labor, filling his speech with lots of statistics. He pointed out that the worker received only 15 cents out of every dollar, while the rest went to the big fat capitalist. The last speaker was Samuel Fielden, F-I-E-L-D-E-N, a 40-year-old teamster who had immigrated from England. His main theme, a statement that had been made by Congressman Foran, F-O-R-A-N, of Ohio, that the working man could expect no relief or aid from legislation. After 10 minutes, a cold wind and rain convinced three-fourths of the crowd not to wait for the end of Fielden's speech. Think that there was a congressman in that date of 1886 who was saying that legislation wouldn't work and only armed struggle would succeed. Shows how much regression we've had in USA. There's no congressman even elected today on a mild socialist platform. They're all afraid to use the word. As Pat, the secretary of Charles Gary, called Ron Dellums' office and said they're a group of socialists, said, don't use that word. Don't expect us to help them if you use that word, referring to us as a group of socialists. Well, at 10:20, he began, in spite of the people running away from the cold, windy city of Chicago because of the rains and the winds. In conclusion, Fielden said, and then, to everyone's amazement, 180 police appeared in formation before he could get the words out of his mouth. They were led by Captains Bonfield, B-O-N-F-I-E-L-D, and Ward. A short interchange took place. Ward, in the name of the people of the state of Illinois, I command this meeting immediately and peaceably to disperse. Fielden, we are peaceful. He, spies, and others began to descend from the truck wagon. Without warning, a makeshift bomb blew up, exploded in front of the police. The police reformed and opened fire. There was a feeble response from the crowd, which quickly dispersed. Recent history has revealed that McCormick, the large capitalist, had arranged for the bomb. So even though police would be injured and killed, it would make an excuse to arrest the emerging socialist movement that had begun more lively in 1886 than it is today. One policeman, Matthias J. Deegan, D-E-G-A-N, died immediately, and six others died in the hospital. Over 70 law officers were injured by the capitalist place bomb. The civilian casualties were 2 dead and an estimated 60 injured. The public was shocked by the affair, and the nation's press, of course, did not reveal that it was the capitalist, McCormick, the manufacturers that had done it. Nay. They universally condemned radicals, anarchists, socialists, communists, and aliens, all foreigners, and particularly Germans. On May 5, the New York Times declared that the anarchists and socialists were guilty of the bomb throwing. Within 2 days, the police, under the command of the infamous torturer, Captain Michael J. Schack, S-C-H-A-A-C-K, raided 50 supposed hangouts of socialists and anarchists and arrested or questioned over 200 socialists and anarchists altogether. Chief of Police Ebersold, speaking 3 years later, said Schack wanted to keep things stirring. He wanted bombs to be found here, there, and everywhere as an excuse for him to carry out his brutal law enforcement. Now here is something the public does not know. After we got the anarchist societies and socialist societies broken up, Shaq wanted to send out men to organize new societies right away. He wanted to keep the pot boiling, keep himself prominent before the public by having these constant interchanges with anarchist and socialist organizers. The police were most concerned, and more concerned with getting evidence against those arrested than in finding the bomb thrower. They offered money and jobs to those who would be witnesses for the state. The atmosphere in Chicago, Illinois was so hostile to radicals, socialists, that the color red, symbolic of revolution, was cut out of street advertisements and banned by the Chicago City Council, that red could not be used on any street advertisements. A grand jury of businessmen indicted 31 persons, but they concentrated their prosecution on 9 men: August Spies, Albert Parsons, a Confederate officer who had married a black woman. She went on later to become one of the great international socialists. Samuel Fielden, Michael Schwab, S-C-H-W-A-B, Adolf Fischer, George Engel, E-N-G-E-L, Oscar Niebe, N-E-E-B-E, Louis Ling, L-I-N-G-G. I want you to take note of these people and see how courageous they were in their day, and compare it since that year of 1886 to the soullessness and spinelessness of the American populace today. Louis Ling was accused of having made the Haymaker bomb, and Rudolf Schnaubelt was the other of the 9 that were indicted, S-C-H-N-A-U-B-E-L-T, who are accused of having thrown it. They were charged with 1, being accessories before the fact to murder of Matthias J. Deegan, law officer, that had been killed by the capitalist bomb. And they were accused of being accessories to murder by a bomb. 2, second count murder by pistol shots. 3, murder 3, accessory to one another in the murder of Officer Deegan. 4, general conspiracy to murder, just like with Newton today, determined to get them on one thing or another. The remaining 22 never came to trial at that time, because several of them purchased immunity by becoming witnesses for the state against these brave socialist leaders. Most were released on $400 bail, but by the end of 1890, 4 years later, all of the 22 had been arrested on some other charge or had been killed. That is the history of Finks always. You may get your immunity for the moment for lying, and then to have to live with a guilty conscience all of your life, but all of them, all 22, were either dead or in jail by 1890, 4 years later. When the trial opened on June 21, only 7 defendants were in court. Parsons and Schnaubelt were missing. Schnaubelt presumably spent the rest of his life in Europe. It's suspected that he even was in Russia to see the first successful socialist revolution in October 1917. But he was never officially located. At 2:30 p.m. on the 21st day of June 1886, Parsons, who had been hiding in Waukesha, W-A-U-K-E-S-H, Wisconsin, walked into the courtroom and sat down with the other defendants. He was the man married to the black woman. His friend William Holmes said, "When I heard that he, Parsons, had gone to Chicago to stand trial, I hastened to the jail. I said to him, 'Do you know what you have done?' And he said, 'Yes, thoroughly. I never expect while I live to be a free man again. They will kill me, but I could not bear to be at liberty knowing that my comrades were here and were to suffer for something of which they were as innocent as I.'" In other words, he could not continue to be free or flee with any of his comrades in jail. So he went there to face death with them. Judge Joseph Eaton Gary refused to let the Chicago 8 be tried separately. A special bailiff Henry L. Rice was appointed to find potential jurors. Rice was blunt about where his sentiments lay. "I am managing this case, and I know what I'm about. Those fellows are going to be hanged as certain as death. I am calling such men as the defendants will have to challenge peremptorily, and so waste their time in challenges. Then they will have to take such men as the prosecution wants." He was going to challenge all of their jurors. And he did. He got the jurors exactly that the prosecution wanted. With the help of Judge Gary, Rice's strategy worked perfectly. Rice is spelled R-Y-C-E. Judge Gary refused to disqualify one potential juror who was a friend of one of the dead policemen, and another who admitted not only to being prejudiced against all anarchists, but to being a relative of one of the dead policemen. The defense was forced to use up its challenges on these and other unacceptable potential jurors. The final jury consisted of 12 white males, only one of whom was foreign-born. 5 of the defendants had been born in Germany and 1 in England. 7 jurors were white-collar workers, 1 an employer of labor, 1 a commercial capitalist agent, and 2 were capitalist businessmen. There were no industrial workers. The U.S.'s farce that you have a right to a jury trial by your peers was, as always, denied, and still is today. The prosecution case was flimsy, to say the least, particularly since they had no evidence that any of the defendants